You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to Archaeotech 73. I'm Chris Webster, your host, with my co-host Paul Zimmerman. And on today's episode, we talk about an article written by Ethan Watrall for SAA Advances called Redland, Blackland. It's all about gamifying archaeology and seeing what we can learn. Let's get to it. All right. Welcome to the podcast. Paul, how's it going?
Oh, pretty good. Chris, how you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. For some reason, everybody likes to talk about the weather, and I don't usually do that. However, I'm going to actually mention that a little bit because it was a little hazardous getting into the studio this morning. We had our first like actual winter weather last night, and now it's, you know, we have a 20 degree high today and like 11 degrees tonight, Fahrenheit. This is February 19th as we're recording this in Reno, Nevada, and it was a little shocking. It's been nice and pleasant over the winter, but this is our first like real taste of winter. It's only going to last like 2 days and then we'll be back to 65 and 70, but it's just a little bit ridiculous. So I guess that groundhog was right, or maybe not. I don't know. I didn't pay attention.
No, I'd never pay attention to him. Puxatawny Phil. We got,
I know, right?
We've had really crazy warm weather for a while here. So there's no snow anywhere. It's been really, really biting into my skiing, but we had a good snowfall the other night. Got about 5 inches here in Brewster. About an hour north of the city. And so I went to go skiing with my son yesterday, and we got to the place, to the closest ski hill. And the line to get the tickets was over an hour long. And I asked somebody, he's like, I've been here over an hour. I just paid somebody $50 to trade places with me in line. And so I said, let's go home. And we went home and went wedding instead. And tomorrow it's supposed to be in the 60s here, and later this week it's supposed to be in the 70s. So this is for the middle of February, it's really unseasonable weather. It's really odd.
Crazy. Well, we've been pretty solidly watching the Winter Olympics, so at least it's cold over there. Unlike, I think, was it Sochi or something like that? They barely had enough snow and cold to even run the Winter Olympics. But South Korea is doing all right for coldness.
Well, someplace, fortunately.
Yeah, right. So, all right. Well, we've got a handful of things we're going to talk about today, and we'll see how much of it we get to and how much we can talk about these individual things. But the first thing I wanted to talk about, since this is an archaeology technology podcast, occasionally I will go to a few of the online journals I have access to, and one of those is Advances in Archaeological Practice. And often there are techie and, you know, at least new things people are doing from a technology standpoint related to archaeology. And we'll take a look at articles in there. But just as a warning, unless you're smarter than I am and already know this, I went and first off, we all know the SAA's website is horribly out of date, and it just looks like a third grader created it for their, you know, History of the Internet project or something like that. It's just, it's so bad. I don't know why they don't just put a little bit of money into it. Does it really cost that much? I mean, I could make them a website on Squarespace tomorrow. So anyway, I know they have a lot of stuff on there and it's not that easy to migrate, but either way, put some money into it. We're paying for it. Regardless, I went there, as I do occasionally, to look at new articles and see what's up there. Well, I clicked on the journal once I signed in, because of course it's behind a paywall. And I clicked on the journal's cover, which is, again, not incredibly intuitive, to bring me into the journal home, they call it. And then they show you the journal up top, and you can click on the journal cover again, which just brings you to the journal, which is incredibly annoying. I'm not actually sure where to actually see the most recent issue of the journal. I guess you click on this little down arrow, then it says latest issues, but it just doesn't show you the latest thing, like right up top, right in front. Instead, there's this whole category called sample content, and I'm not sure who decided this was going to be sample content. I'm not sure how they curated this little list of sample articles, but I completely missed the word sample content, even though they're big right in my face and right below, right where I get there, right above the articles. But your brain just assumes that these are the latest articles. Why wouldn't they be highlighting that? Why wouldn't the latest articles be the first thing you come to when you get to this journal? That boggles the mind. Anyway, I clicked on one and we tried to get the author on here. His name's Ethan Watrall. He goes by Captain Primate on Twitter. Follow him. He's got some great stuff. He's doing some amazing things. Always has some really cool things to say. But I clicked on this article thinking that it was a more recent article. And I actually sent him a message on Twitter saying, hey, do you have time to record? And I don't know if he looked at it and said, I don't want to talk about something that I did 4 years ago, because it turns out this came out in 2014, or if he really didn't just didn't have time, because he said he didn't have time right now to get into an interview. And now I feel like a schmuck, because afterwards I noticed at the bottom of the PDF I downloaded for the article that it says February of 2014 on it. And I thought, well, that's got to be a mistake somehow, because I think this just came out. And turns out, no, in fact, it did not. So anyway, the article, you can find it in SAA's Advances in Archaeological Practice, Volume 2, Issue 1, February 2014. And it is called Redland, Blackland, Teaching Ancient Egyptian Archaeology Through Digital Game-Based Learning. So, all right. Well, after all that, maybe I'll let you go, Paul. Paul, what were your first impressions of this article? Or maybe should we summarize what it's about a little bit?
Okay, let's summarize it about. It's a description about a project that was done, a programming project, basically, using Civ 5 as an engine for teaching Egyptology and Egyptian archaeology. And it's a description of the project, how it was organized, what the goals were, who was working on it, what they were doing, how the project evolved over the course of the pilot program that was being done. And some of the outcomes from it, some of the things learned. And so it's nicely logically laid out. I'm sure that they grabbed this one as sample content, because it's a quite clear, well-written, informative little article. You know, maybe don't tell the 8-bit test pit people, but I tend to be always a little skeptical of archaeo gaming, and you know, not out of any real knowledge. You know, I don't follow the literature on archaeo gaming. I'm not a gamer myself. I'm old enough, I think, that that probably it's just my gut reaction. Games are fit over there on one side that is for entertainment, and it's hard to shoehorn that into you know, educational content or informational content. I know that gut reaction of mine is wrong, and actually reading this article highlights quite well ways that certain researchers like Wattrall are actually trying to change that and trying to adopt certain methods, certain techniques of gameplay, and adapt them to things with pedagogical content, and seriously assessing what works and what doesn't work. So, you know, it's interesting if that's your interest. You know, it's a 4-year-old article, but I think that a lot of it probably still holds very true.
Yeah, I think it does. And, you know, if we want to, well, first off, to the 8-bit test pit crowd, if you even know what we're talking about, with that podcast was kind of short lived, because the people we had hosting that podcast, and I'm not saying this in any sort of disparaging way, I'm saying it in an encouraging way, the people we had posting that podcast are actually doing a ton of work, and they're working on PhDs and stuff, and they really just didn't have time for it, which I fully understand. So if you are interested in archaeogaming and you're hearing this and you're doing some things in this space, I mean, there's some people I want to talk to from this article. Katie Myers, I think, is one of them. I mean to contact her, because she's mentioned in the article as one of the programmers for getting this thing going. We would love to have some hosts continue that conversation, so people do get to understand exactly what we mean by archaeogaming, because a lot of people think that archaeogaming is really just talking about video games that deal with archaeology. And the first thing that comes to most everyone's mind is Tomb Raider, because that was kind of, you know, aside from any small crappy games based on the Indiana Jones movies, Tomb Raider was like, you know, Tomb Raider the game came before Tomb Raider the movie, whereas Indiana Jones the movie came before Indiana Jones the game, probably because they couldn't make an Indiana Jones video game that was any quality in like 1984 or whatever the hell the thing came out. But archaeogaming is not just about archaeology as it's represented in video games, although that is a large component of it. It can be about other things, like how history in general is represented in video games. A lot of times it follows the Indiana Jones methodology, where it's like punching Nazis and stealing treasure and, you know, collecting the things and not really having any cultural sensitivity whatsoever. And sometimes, though, we actually talked about this on a podcast a long time ago about archaeogaming being like, I guess, preserving video game environments. Now, one of the things that came up was World of Warcraft. World of Warcraft has been around since, geez, what, like the late 90s, early 2000s at this point. It's like a 20-year-old universe now that's been created by the programmers, but also modified and lived in by millions and millions of people. And it's got its own landscape. And at some point, we have to look at the National Register. When we think of the National Register of Historic Places, the default condition for being considered for the register is it's over 50 years old. But that's not the only thing where you can start consideration. There's four criteria for getting listed. And the 50-year rule does not necessarily have to apply. For example, things that are significant events to human history are on the National Register. I mean, if somebody nominates it, it's on there almost immediately if it was a significant event. For example, the 9/11 site, the World Trade Center site, is on the National Register of Historic Places. Definitely not 50 years old, but is important to events in the nation's history. So I think we could arguably say that World of Warcraft, whether you like it or not, whether you're into online gaming like that or not, significantly had an effect on the gaming landscape at that time, and really changed how we see multiplayer online games and how people interact. I mean, people got married in World of Warcraft, like physically reality married. They had their ceremony in World of Warcraft in character. I mean, come on, there's some significance there. So yeah, I mean, we can get back to the article here, but that's kind of, you know, where RQ Gaming sits. And I was fascinated. I had really nothing much to contribute to the RQ Gaming podcast, or I'd have tried to keep it going myself. But we need somebody who's actually studying this stuff and really keeping up on current research and what's going on to take that back over. But maybe we can talk to Ethan, and some of his students can take that podcast over. I don't know.
Yeah. So my skepticism of RQ Gaming, you know, the gut. Not a serious skepticism, just my first initial reaction is actually kind of ironic because, I've been working at the Dalton School in Manhattan for 17 years, I think now. My first introduction was in 98 because they have a virtual dig that could arguably be called an Archeo game. And they were looking at making a new version of it using materials from the University of Pennsylvania Museum where I was at. And I was brought along because I could talk both archaeology and computers to all the people involved in the project. That project didn't happen, but they did have the original project, which was an excavation of a site in Syria, an Assyrian site on the Euphrates called Til Barsip. And we've redesigned that program a few times. It was originally done in HyperCard and then updated to SuperCard. And then there were new updates to SuperCard. And then there was in Director. And now it's an HTML deliverable. Mm-hmm. So it's gone through a lot of generations. And I've been involved in that quite a bit over the years. So, you know, my skepticism, you have to take it with a grain of salt because, you know, here I have been.
For sure.
And actively seeing how something that could be arguably called a game is used very effectively in teaching, in this case, in teaching sixth graders. So I do understand that there is a great pedagogical potential for certain games. And it really depends on the presentation and the intent that was put into it. And I would think also a large part the expertise and the goals of the people who are designing it. Because, you know, we complain about, we as archaeologists complain about how archaeology is represented on TV constantly. And that's because most of the people who are representing archaeology on TV aren't interested in representing archaeology as we understand it. They're interested in selling ad bucks by doing something sensational. Well, mm-hmm. With regards to Redline Blackland, Wattrall is clearly bringing a lot of archaeological expertise and archaeological sensitivities and trying to highlight those, trying to foreground them in various ways through the gameplay. And so let me just read here quickly what the goals are paraphrased here. He had three main goals starting with. It was to explore cultural change that's pre-dynastic through New Kingdom Egypt, to expose players to supplementary information about the construction of archaeological knowledge. And that's the part that I found most interesting in what was presented in the article. And then also to provide an engaging counterpoint to the sensationalist kind of pseudo-archaeology that often surrounds popular portrayals of Egypt, you know, to get something that mm-hmm. people are going to be involved in and interested in, people being students, that is going to show them a different thing than they could otherwise get on cable TV or on most things on the internet. And you know, so those are three very big, very laudable goals. And you know, with varying success, seems like they accomplished them. But they had some challenges along the way. Do you want to discuss any of those?
Yeah, let's do that. I want to mention one thing he mentioned before he got into the goals that I had just a slight issue with because it relates to the challenges they had in doing this. He said he said, I'll just quote him right here. He says right in the first, like on the second page, he says, fewer still attempt to communicate that the primary goal of archaeology is keenly focused not on description, but on building generalizable theory that explains diachronic human behavior. And I'll tell you what, that is a very academic view of the purpose of archaeology. because for the rest of the country, for the 80 to 90% of people who are doing archaeology in this country, the primary purpose, the primary goal of contract field archaeology is actually description, because sometimes we don't have time to create generalizable theory. We have to rely on other people to do that. We have to actually describe as best we can. And I think that power of description is not something that's taught enough. It's not, we focus so much on the theory. We don't focus on really accurately describing something without bias as much as possible, in a way that other people can look at later and then make other interpretations based on newer thinking, newer methodologies. You know, let's look at this old stuff again. If they recorded it in a way that is preservable and sustainable, then we should be able to apply newer thinking and newer theories to these old data sets. And that, I think, really is the primary goal of archaeology. It is the study of human history, don't get me wrong. And maybe the overarching primary goal of archaeology is to create generalized theories. I understand that. But I guess I feel like it was a little disingenuous to a lot of the actual practicing field archaeologists in the country saying that's your goal, where we have slightly different goals that are maybe, like I said, a subset of the larger goal. But still, I wanted to bring that up because that's really important to me.
Yeah, I caught that too. And I was thinking somewhat along the same lines. I was actually focusing more on the general kind of covering laws that he's arguing that archaeologists do, which certainly a lot do, and it's very laudable. But some archaeologists aren't so interested in general covering laws, but actually trying to find out the specifics of, I mean, it's very old fashioned archaeology, but culture, history, mm-hmm. what happened, how did people live in certain places, when, why, and what happened to them? You know, which I think is also a perfectly valid aspect of the field, and one that has to be done before any general covering laws can be can be made. In that one brief sentence, I'm sure he understands the complexities of it, but in that one brief sentence, it did gloss over a lot of different ways that that the field has developed over the last century and a half.
Right. And it might go to explain why the results were as they were and some of the challenges they had that we're going to talk about. But let's do that after the break, since we're up against this and I want to have time to talk about that. So in the meantime, we're trying to do a lot of really crazy things here at the Archaeology Podcast Network. But to do that, we're not focusing on advertising. Again, the ads you hear on these shows are for other shows on the network or for things that the network is doing. We will take in advertising if somebody wants to come, but we're not actually, you know, actively really seeking that, because we want to promote our membership site. So if you're interested, go to archpodnet.com/members and check out one of the membership levels today. Even at the $5 a month level, I'll send you a little card with a personal note in it and a sticker, and you'll be helping us keep the lights on and do some awesome things here. So thanks for that. And we'll see you on segment two in just a minute.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to archpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high quality downloads of each show and a discount at our online store, and access to show hosts on a members only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to archpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's archpodnet.com/members.
All right, welcome back to Archaeotech Podcast, episode 73. We left off the last segment talking about Redland, Blackland, an article in SA Advances from Ethan Watrell, and it's from February 2014. There's a link, the DOI link is in the show notes for this, so you can go check that out if you have access. If you don't have access, send me a message. We'll figure something out. All right, so we were going to talk about some of the challenges to this, and I think one of the first major challenges they had to this was they immediately scaled back what they wanted to do, because they were going to cover like thousands of years of Egyptian history, and they realized, holy crap, we don't have the funding for that. I mean, they had some pretty good funding, it sounds like. I can't remember what the numbers were, but they were going to cover a lot of time space in this thing, and it just, they ended up having to really, really truncate that down because they realized that the programming for that was going to be a lot. And just to back up real fast, Civilization 5, which is what they're using at the time, I don't know if there's a new one, but It allowed you to do mods to the game, which means anybody can download the package here. But you still have to code. You still have to make things. But you could basically create your own worlds within the framework that they already set up. So you didn't have to invent a video game platform and architecture if you were going to work within their world, which is something I didn't even know about. I never really was into the whole Civilizations thing, but it makes me really intrigued by the possibilities that that could offer. But it still means you have to spend a lot of time creating stuff and a lot of time making things. It's just, you know, they did a lot of the hard work to start it out, but it still does require a lot of work later on. And they definitely realized that. What were some of the other challenges you noted, Paul?
Well, the big one, like you said, was it was just too much. I mean, those goals that we outlined were big high level sorts of goals, what they would want to get out of the project. But then one of the problems hinted to by what you were just saying is that they were, they're using Civ 5, and the Civilization games are very much open-ended. You know, there's a lot that you can do on them. They're not as open-ended as something like World of Warcraft, but there's a lot of different ways that the games can go. And they were hoping to leverage that to do thousands of years of history, and it was just too much. So what they ended up doing was breaking it down into six distinct scenarios, each with a clearly defined win state. Mm-hmm. And then by focusing it like that, they could revise what they were doing. And instead of having one big game that went forever and did all the stuff, they had basically six mini games all built on the same platform. And I think that was actually a pretty wise decision on their part, because it made for an easier development, but also it means that you can then deploy the game at different times. If you're using it in your curriculum, if you're teaching people about ancient Egypt and you want to use the game as one of the tools for the lessons, or as ancillary materials in your coursework, you could break it down. And the different scenarios they had were pre-dynastic, old kingdom, first intermediate period, middle kingdom, second intermediate period, and new kingdom, each of which had a very distinct kind of win scenario. So pre-dynastic was unifying upper and lower Egypt. Old kingdom was building a pyramid. I can't remember what all the other ones were, kicking out Hyksos, I think, and I could probably just look at the article here and tell you exactly. You'll get the idea. What they did is, you don't need to know. You can read it if you're interested. But they broke it down then into those smaller sort of sub games. And I think that was a smart idea for how to deal with this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, more manageable chunks.
Yeah, more manageable chunks, which is right. That's everything in life.
right.
Everything in life. Don't take the huge project on, just as a huge project. Try to break it down into bite-sized chunks and deal with those one at a time.
Which you know, to not leave that too quickly, that's actually a pretty genius way to do it. Because if somebody were to do this initial step like they did, and I'd like to see... well, first off, this is 4 years old, so I'd like to see where this has gone from here. But I'd like to see also if they took that 3,000 year span of time that they were originally looking at and broke it up into all the chunks, instead of what I think they did was they really just brought it down into these six things that they talked about. If they'd broken that whole thing up and said, okay, we're going to tackle the first six, or we're going to tackle randomly these six, but we now have a framework for actually doing this. We now have a system in place and a framework for doing this, so other people could come along and say, well, I'm going to take this and I'm going to take this. Because I think they did put some of their stuff up on GitHub for how they did these things, and it was accessible. And honestly, they'd probably just hand it to you and say, here's what we did. go to town. But to have other people work on those things and to think about doing that for all kinds of stuff within archaeology and within human history, and saying, hey, we need some people to just break this up into logical pieces based on their cultural knowledge of the area and what makes sense. And here's a platform for doing this. Let's outsource it. And everybody, you know, or crowdsource it, I guess I should say. And everybody does, their part to contributing to it. I think that'd be great.
Yeah, it would be. And one of the things, you know, the breaking it down into these different scenarios, I think he mentions that Civ 5 as a gaming engine is built very much on late 19th, early 20th centuries notions of cultural change. And so trying to do a huge project that span that gives it a very unilineal sort of development that they wanted to get away from. As you know, as 21st century archaeologists, we don't want to promote these unilineal cultural evolutionary views that have usually one prime mover that accounts for everything. But if you break it down into little chunks, then you can pick out one or two salient or important elements of the culture of that time period and focus on those without necessarily shoehorning the entirety of ancient Egypt into one single timeline, into one single straight. This leads to that, leads to the other thing, sort of sequence of events.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's maybe a little less fraught if you focus it on a clearly defined goal and in a short period of time. So from a theoretical pedagogical standpoint, I thought that was also an interesting take on it, and that also highlights a major limitation of using Civ as the engine is that again, it's not. It's written by people who have a love of history, but it's not necessarily written with the intent of teaching history.
Right?
It's playing a historical-ish game. Well, taking something that's done for one purpose and trying to repurpose it for teaching, maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. But they had to work within that so that way they didn't have to create their entire game engine on their own. And one thing that I really did like in terms of the educational content, and maybe this is my being an old guy and thinking that this is interesting and nobody else would understand this or like it, but I really did like what they did with the concept of the learning agents. And they had these learning agents, four distinct ones, which each kind of typified a stereotypical archaeologist or Egyptologist from a certain time or place, and they would chime in periodically explaining their point of view of how certain developments happened as you reached certain landmarks in the scenarios. And I thought that was a really cool thing to bring into the game. I don't know how much of that is available natively in Civ because I haven't played Civ since Civ 2 maybe. But I thought that was a good way of adding some fairly concrete educational content that's not easily brought into the gameplay, but can be added kind of almost as another layer onto the gameplay. So they were really being experimental. They were really trying to push the bounds of what they could do, and different ways of presenting the information, different ways of allowing the players to discover information without letting it totally off the rails and become absolutely freeform, or without shoehorning it into a very very, very linear progression that would cover the 3,000 years. Neither would particularly acceptable for an educational tool.
Exactly. Yeah. So let's talk about some of the ways once they quote finish development, although every developer knows you're never finished with development. Never. And this is what we're going to talk about. So some of the issues that they ran into, well, first off, Their distribution of this was shockingly small for as much money was poured into it. I'm really surprised that they didn't try to bring this out to a wider gaming community. I mean, it was 2014 and plenty of forums out there that they could have posted this on and said, hey, check this out and give us your feedback. Maybe they didn't have the infrastructure to deal with that feedback, because if they've got it in the right places, it could have been massive. Because they did have four students, which again, surprises me even a little bit, already owned a copy of Civilization V. I didn't know it was that popular of a game. But I don't know if that's four out of how many. They just said four already owned it. And they were able to provide two more copies to a small test group. So only six people actually got to play this in the actual game environment at the time of the writing of this article. I don't know if they've had more people play it since then, but or if it's even still playable. But either way, most of the thing that they encountered were technical issues, it says, which is, again, not surprising. This is the first time they'd gone down this road. Development is very hard. Even if you're an experienced developer, getting into a new platform and figuring out how that's going to work with itself is a challenge. I mean, you're going to run into problems. There's always technical issues. I don't think a single build of any app in the history of app development was deployed without bugs. It's just not possible, right? It's too complicated. So this is nothing, no slight on the developers that were working on this, the archaeologists who turned developers and then the other people they had working on it. It's just part of the part of the game, you know, part of the game, so to speak.
It's part of the development process. And that's something we bump up against anytime I've had to develop software is how people are actually going to use it. And, you know, you build it from your own perspective and you know, whoever you're working on with the team and you know how the software should be used. Well, somebody, once you release it, is going to try doing something different that you forgot to ever think about. And it'll either work or it'll fail spectacularly. And then you have to go back and fix it and account for the various ways that people do things that you never considered in the first place. So, you know, that's something that applies not just to the Archeo gaming, it applies to all software development. And, you know, so we've talked a lot about different kinds of digital data collection. It's something, you know, you have to test it yourself and you have to beta test with other people to make sure that... that what makes sense to you makes sense to other people and that what makes sense to them doesn't break the software entirely. So, they obviously ran into this to some extent.
Yeah, they did. Some of the results from the students that took this said that they felt that the interactive and entertaining nature of the game enhanced their learning experience, but they didn't believe that was a replacement for other learning materials such as lectures or readings. Must have been grad students, because I think undergrads would have said, hell yeah, let's play video games. But anyway, and then they said more generally, the students appreciated the idea of game-based learning within an archaeology course or any university course for that matter. I think obviously the data are in about people learning from video games. People might say that you don't learn anything from video games, but I'll tell you what, even if what you're learning is not to go around that corner and because you'll get shot by the alien and then to memorize this map and do all these things, if the gameplay is interactive and really engaging, people are going to learn. We just have to focus what they learn. And I think in my experience, a lot of educationally focused archaeology things that I've seen in the past, and it hasn't been a lot because there hasn't been much out there, but a lot of it, if you're not shooting stuff and if you're not jumping and punching things and doing stuff like that, then people aren't excited about it. So while we don't want to introduce that element into archaeology games necessarily, ones that have a high learning content, we need to find a way to actually make these things exciting. And I think the one of the first things that the 8-Bit Test Pit covered was that new game that came out last summer, maybe it was a couple summers ago. What was it called? That one that's in space. It's a progressively generated universe and you check out these planets and stuff. Anyway, whatever that was called, I can't remember what it was called, but that I think is the idea. You include exploration as the major driving element for an archaeology game. And you just, the art of discovery, you know, the act of discovery, I should say, that's one of the things that archaeologists love the most. I mean, we get excited about things to a certain extent. We get excited about finding, you know, making connections and saying, well, this artifact is related to this and it means this for this whole society. Sure, that's exciting. And that's probably better for our long-term careers. But we all know that the moment of discovery is the most exciting thing as an archaeologist. The uncovering of something that you didn't know was there, or maybe you suspected was there, and then you saw it. That is the quintessential archaeological experience that even experienced archaeologists will tell you they get a thrill out of that discovery. And we just need to translate that to some sort of gaming platform and then include the educational elements as part of the game, and people will learn from it. I think they will. So I don't know if they hit that in this because I never played the game, but looking at their screenshots and things, they had a lot of text. And you know, text isn't the best way to convey a point in a video game. I'll tell you that right now. People try to skip past it and they just want to get to the action.
those learning agents is that you have to read, you know, what they're trying to tell you and then absorb it. And I don't know how directly it applies to the game itself or if it's just kind of background information. Not the background information is bad, but it, you know, it kind of misses a point in a game, I think.
Yeah, it makes it so you have to want to know that information, not that you're required to know that information to progress through the game. Exactly. You know, when you're required to know, like we all sat through Legend of Zelda when they were bobbing their little heads around and explaining back and forth what they were going to do because they're giving you important information for the game, right? It's a kind of a boring thing they put in back in the Nintendo days. And it's just like, oh, you know, dude's talking to this guy and it's just back and forth and you're reading this text and you're like, God, I just want to get to the game. But you have to read that. Or you're going to miss something. You're going to have to go back and listen to it again. The learning agents were great, it looks like in the article here. But like you said, Paul, they just weren't unnecessary part of it. So you're just going to skip right past it, honestly, if you're trying to get to the end. The whole gamification of everything, this is where the word gamification comes from. We're gamifying everything. I mean, my Prius was gamified. It would give you little, you know, you basically get points if you were more energy efficient, and it means nothing to anyone. And there's literally no prizes except for, obviously, the planet gets a prize. But people don't even care about that. People don't even care about the environmental consequence. I mean, obviously, some people do. But the gamification of it, the saying you're achieving these things, there's no way to do that as far as I can tell in the model they used here. So that's actually understanding the psychology of gamification, I think, would go a long ways to make archaeology gaming more effective. But who knows? It also takes millions of dollars.
Well, the gamification, actually, that to keep people on track. I mean, again, I was talking about the Till Barsip virtual dig on at the school that I work. And that's one thing that we have to deal with all the time, is that there's inevitably one kid in each class that decides that it's his job to dig everything up as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. And it's not like that at all. It's not an actual game. It's a directed activity, and they have to go slowly, and they have to discuss what they see as they unearth different blocks in their quad, and they have to map what they find and describe any artifacts that they find and so on. But there's always mm-hmm. somebody that just wants to clear the entire screen right away, right. Out of some sense of, oh, I did this, I got to do the next one. And can be a great motivator if you're doing something like, if you've ever used Duolingo for language learning.
Oh yeah.
It's a great motivator. Oh, I got through one step. I can get through the next step. I've got, 15 minutes. I can probably get through it. And so it pulls you along like that. But sometimes if you're using it to try to teach, it's actually the wrong way. You got to put the brakes on it. So it's again, another tricky question, and one that's way above my pay grade, because I haven't paid much attention to it other than how we use it actually ourselves in class. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think you're right that appropriate gamification could probably be a very good way to drive interest in a well-crafted archaeogaming game. Right. Yeah.
Archaeo game. Yeah.
That's the word.
So there you go. Yeah. I think that one of their final conclusions here, it's funny, they didn't really mention their goals much in the final conclusions, because what they found out through the process of this was making video games is hard. And it actually says that. It's like creating a digital game is not easy. And that was one of the big takeaways that they had. And they said, actually, because it sounds like with their sample set being so small and the number of people they had working on it to create it, they were most effective in educating people about archaeology and the human past that were not archaeologists. So the people that were involved in the creation of this thing actually learned quite a bit in just actually creating it, which, sure, that's a valid thing to say in the conclusions, but obviously not massively sustainable and not a huge way. To teach people about archaeology, we shouldn't have to have them design games about archaeology, because very few people are going to do that. So, but I appreciate that they said that, and it's good that the people working on this actually learned something, which is nice. I think we just need a solid idea and plan moving forward for some sort of game that matches all the other games that are out there, but again, maintains cultural sensitivity and doesn't paint archaeology in an Indiana Jones sort of light, but gamifies heavily and gets things done. So who knows? Maybe we have to actually mine Bitcoin in games, and then people actually get Bitcoin or something like that as prizes. I think money's always a common motivator. Now we're back to treasure hunting. So
yep, there you go.
Yeah. All right. It always comes back to treasure hunting. Okay. Well, we didn't think we'd talk about this for two full segments, but it turns out we did. And that's great. I think I want to see more articles like this, and there probably are, since this is a 4-year-old article. Thanks for that, SAA website. And we'll go from there, and maybe I can get Ethan Watrall's thoughts on this, because he usually goes to the Society for American Archaeology conferences, and I'm going in December, and I'll probably go to the Digital Data Interest Group meeting like I usually do, because they have a fantastic series of lightning talks. It's usually on Friday nights. I haven't seen the schedule to see if it's there, but if you're there, say hi, and I'm going to try to get Ethan to make a comment on this, and maybe get an update on what's happened with this project or follow-on projects from this since then. So, it's great that we have academic and university environments that can get the grants, spend the kind of money to actually put in print the results of something like this, something I would have thought would have been somewhat intuitive, but that's not how science works. You know, your thesis is making games is hard. They proved it, and now they're going to move on, adjust, and go another direction. So that's good. All right. Well, we will link to that in the show notes. Check it out. I'll have Ethan Watrall's Twitter handle in the show notes. It's Captain Primate. I think it's Captain_Primate or something like that. But I'll have that in the show notes. And we're going to come back in just a second for our app of the day segment. Want some all-weather vinyl stickers for your water bottle, clipboard, or whatever else? Check out our show stickers at arcpodnet.com/stickers, and we'll ship you some today. That's arcpodnet.com/stickers. Now back to the show. Okay, we are back to Archaeotech 73, and this is the App of the Day segment. And I'm just remembering, literally as I'm saying this, that we had somebody who I know who's back on the East Coast who has a band mention possibly writing some music for the App of the Day segment. So that would be a nice thing to have a little App of the Day segment intro. But I got to get with him on that and have him create something. I don't know if he's ever done like a 15-second song before, because we don't want something very long. I know. I'm imagining like a Wayne's World thing where it's like, app of the day.
Party down. Excellent.
Nice. We totally need to put that together when next time we're like physically in the same space. That would be awesome.
SAAs, maybe.
That's right. So the app I'm going to talk about, and we've talked about this on the Archaeotech podcast before. We've interviewed them on the Archaeotech podcast before, but I'm mentioning the app because things have changed. And I'm mentioning it as an app and not a company now that you can, we're just going to talk about that's doing things. And that app is WildNote. And you're probably going to start hearing a few WildNote ads. I mentioned earlier in the podcast that we don't typically seek out ads, but I've got a relationship with WildNote now. And full disclosure, because I can say this now because we actually signed the contract, I am now, I think the title we came up with, and we were just trying to figure something out, but the title we came up with was CRM Client Specialist. But basically what that means is I'm the first archaeologist that WildNote has essentially hired. I'm still pretty much a contractor in this relationship. I'm not like hired as an employee just yet. It's a multi-phase system that we're working on, so they can, I mean, they're a full like legit company. I hate to say that, but they're a full legit company and they're doing everything right. They have lawyers write up the contract. They have, you know, they have funding and they have all these things going on. They have tons of users right now. They're all in the biology and like birding space, you know, that people looking out for birds' nests and other animals and things like that. And there's people doing other studies with the WildNote platform. But this is the first time that they're branching into archaeology. And since they're based in San Luis Obispo, California, they're starting with the California forums. Oh, also, since we're both going to be at the WildNote and the APN are both going to be at the Society for California Archaeology meetings on March 8th through the 11th, I believe it is, in San Diego. So if you're there, check us out. We called them and our booths are going to be next to each other because I'm going to be going between the booths talking to people. But I'm telling you this because WildNote, like I said, it's a legit, you know, application that you can download on any device right now, Android and iOS. You could probably use it on a Windows phone or Windows machine. I can't remember if they have a Windows app. However, you can use it in a browser. So if you have cell service on a non-iOS or Android device, you can actually just use it in a browser if you have service to allow that to work. So, you know, not the best solution there, but most people have some sort of Android or iOS device to use it on. And they're making a few changes. So the pricing model is going to be around $50 a month. There's going to be annual and possibly seasonal pricing to bring that price actually down if you get the annual price. But that's something we talk about on a case-by-case basis, depending on the number of users that you have. And then also, they have a platform where you basically go to their survey library, what they call it. And I'm attempting to get them to change the name of this, but it fits for all their current clients. So I'm not sure if they will or not. But they use the word survey in the sense of, like SurveyMonkey, you know, they're asking people questions. Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said, you say survey to archaeologists and they're going to think they're out walking in the desert or digging shovel tests. And that's, you know, so we got to make sure we get the terminology down here. So I don't know if they're going to change it to forms or something like a forms library, but right now it's called the survey library. And so you go up there, you're on the web browser, you download a survey, a form basically into a new project that you're doing. And then you can actually edit that, which is pretty great. They can lock it if they want, but they don't. You can edit that, move fields around, do whatever you want to do. And then you can actually create your own as well using their platform, which is pretty nice, but they've done a lot of the work to create things on their own. And you just use the, so once you have it in your project in the browser-based system, you basically open it up on your tablet or smartphone and then sync your phone to your account. And now you have those available on your device. And now you can go out offline and record information, no service necessary, and do whatever you want. And right now they're creating the California forms. We've got some other things coming out that'll be applicable to the rest of the country. And we're moving across the country to make sure everybody's site forms get in there and some other fun goodies as well coming along the line in the next 6 months or so. So, but the reason I'm telling you this as an app of the day segment is because you can go online right now to your smartphone or tablet, download the WildNote app, sign up for an account, and you get a free 30-day trial that is fully featured. So you can go in there, download whatever they have, play with it. You could actually go out and record archaeological sites if you wanted to create some of the forms that they don't have right now, but they will have soon. Or they might have some stuff by the time you hear this that you can just, you know, download and use and then check that out. And I think having a free 30-day trial is absolutely awesome, because that's the biggest barrier to entry is trust with most archaeologists and apps. It's like, I don't know what the hell this thing's going to do. Am I going to buy it? What if I don't like it? And then I'm out at least a few hundred dollars or something like that. And that's tight for a lot of companies, even just a few hundred dollars. But the ability to try it for free for 30 days and still save yourself potentially thousands of dollars if you do it right. I mean, who wouldn't sign after that, quite frankly, because the price is unbeatable on top of that. So I want some feedback as the person who's basically consulting with them and saying, hey, this is what the clients are saying. This is what people are saying they want. I've gone down this road a few times before, so I'm pretty well versed in what needs to happen, but it's also great to have feedback from people who are actually using the platform and, you know, not only submitting bugs and things like that, because like we said before, there's always bugs, but not only submitting that kind of stuff, but saying, hey, in a perfect world, this is what I would like to see. This is what I would like to see it happen. And I'd love to be able to bring that to developers and see what they can create. So check it out. WildNoteApp.com is the website. Just search WildNote on Android or iOS. Download it. Get the free trial. Again, you have to start some things in the web browser and then port it over to the phone, which is actually a pretty good system once you get used to it and start looking at it. From the web browser, you can export to, for the forms that they have created, you can export to Word, PDF, and raw data. So all that's looking really, really good. So that's the official WildNote app of the day segment. Like I said, we mentioned them before, but now it's getting real for archaeology. So it's finally time to promote that as something that we can use. And I've used it, and it actually does exactly what it says it's going to do. It's pretty great. You know, there's probably 7,000 more features you can put in an application like this, but we're starting on the ground floor here and saying, listen, most people just want to get something off the shelf, record archaeology sites, and come home and save some money and save some time. And that's what this does. So as with all apps, there will be more features coming out later, but this is an excellent first start for archaeology and I think going to be an answer moving forward for a lot of people. So
you had them on the Architect podcast a while ago, some of the developers, yeah. Right? Do you remember how long ago that was?
Yeah, it was like back in September or something. I'll link to that in the show notes so you guys can listen to them. It's the president of the company who's actually an app developer. She's not an environmental scientist at all, which is great because she understands app development. She has a company called SunToucher Apps, which they do all kinds of app development, and they just managed to hook up with these guys and create WildNote as a separate company. And then the other person was Nancy Douglas, and she is, she's like marketing and customer relations or something like that. But anyway, she was the other person to talk about that. And between the two of them, they've got a team built that is WildNote. So yeah, I'll link to that episode in the show notes, because it was right before you joined us, Paul, I think like back in August or something like that.
Yeah. That's how I recall. I seem to remember working out in the yard last summer, listening to it. It was very interesting. It was at the time, it was with respect to the archaeology or using it for archaeology, rather. It was not even a work in progress. I think it was, that's an interesting, maybe we can do that. So it's interesting to see. It would be interesting to go back, re-listen to that and compare what's happened over the last 6 or 9 or 12 months, whatever it is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they actually weren't thinking about archaeology at all. And we brought it to them in that podcast as a concept. And then, you know, I talked to them a few times after that. And I think it was January, early January this year. I hadn't heard much from him regarding that. You know, I follow him on the socials and all that, but we hadn't really discussed it more. And I sent him an email and said, listen, if you guys are ready, the time is now. Let's do this. And we started putting the paperwork together, and now it's coming together. So there you go.
That's great. That's a fun time to work on a project when everything starts coming together.
Exactly. And a project that actually has funding and time and the resources to do this, which is also great.
Those are all critical.
So I know at the SCAs, we actually have something to sell. It's going to be awesome standing in a booth when somebody says, great, when can I get my hands on this? I'll be like, sign right here. It's yours. Done. You know, it finished. Go use it. Have fun. So, yeah. All right. What do you got, Paul?
All right. Well, I'm glad that you're talking about Wild Notes because I've got another note-taking app here. I mentioned in episode 72, the Tech on a Budget, how I'd picked up a very cheap Kindle Fire 7-inch, and have been exploring some different Android apps. And so I was looking, just going to Google Play and started, mind you, Google Play, you have to sideload it to get it onto one of these mm-hmm. Fires. But I did that, and I was looking around to see if there's anything for archaeology, and I found something that really piqued my interest. It was called Field Notes, two words, an archaeological notebook. And so I downloaded it, and it's kind of at the opposite side right now of where WildNote is. WildNote looks like it's ramping up and becoming more real. This, I think, is abandonware now because it hasn't been updated since April 2015. And even in its current state, it looks to be more of a proof of concept than an actual usable app. One thing in particular is that you can't actually download data out of it. So take your notes and have them locked in here. It makes it very much like, you know, using a paper notebook. It's written by a Portuguese archaeological consulting firm. They still have links to it on their website, and we'll put that in the show notes. And there's basically two different kinds of notes that you can do. You create a, you know, you launch the app and go into create a new task. And there are two different kinds of tasks, survey and excavation. Mm-hmm. Brief description, task name, start date, end name, and place to fill out whoever's responsible for it. Once you go into, and I'm going to start here with the survey that I started making a sample survey, we can then add, we can add points in the terminology of the app. Basically, these are samples, right? Mm-hmm. So we can have a description of it. We have geographic coordinates, lat, long, altitude, environmental description, and then cultural remains, and it just has check boxes. So, and not all that many. They're pottery, tile, brick, lithics, metals, glass, and other. So also very limited as to what you could do. Description, time, responsible. You could take a photograph and have that embedded in the form right there. Excavations have a little more detail. If you make an excavation task, the primary unit is the pit. So you create excavation tasks with the same sort of information, task type, description, start date, end date, person responsible. And then once you go in, you have pits, pit number, methodology, description, interpretation, observations, and this is all just text entry, a place for that you can upload a photo. And then you can go one level deeper. Each pit can have multiple stratigraphic units. And the stratigraphic units are broken down into layer, structure, vertical interface, horizontal interface, human remains, which again is kind of limited.
A little bit.
And then description of the stratigraphic relationships above, below, cuts, cut by, fills, filled by, contemporary with, same as methodology, interpretation, chronology, but it's all text. It's I was really excited when I saw this in the Google Play Store, and I downloaded it and started playing with it a little bit and realized pretty quickly that, like I said, it's a proof of concept. It's, you know, pretty looking, but that's about it. I don't think it's actually a usable app for anybody.
Right.
This is not available on iOS. So if you're in the iOS ecosystem, you can't download this to find out how inappropriate it is for your work, but it is available on Android. And again, it's not really usable for anything, but it's interesting as a learning tool. I think if you're developing software, if you're thinking about how you're using tablets in particular for field recording to see what kinds of things other people are struggling with, what kinds of ideas they're trying to bake into their apps, and try to get a sense of different ways that you could go. I mean, this, again, it has been updated now in almost 3 years. So I think they released it. They realized that to make it actually a usable product would have been a lot more time and a lot more effort than they were able to put into it at the time. They still have it linked on their website. So maybe the intent is to revive the project, but, so far, it's the only thing that I've seen on Android that's specifically geared for archaeologists. And yeah, I'd give it, solid B for effort, mm-hmm. and somewhere like a C-, D plus for execution.
Oh my. Yeah. Yeah, I was trying to find it on the iOS App Store, as you mentioned that, before you said it wasn't available. So, yeah. I mean, it's, again, this is a hard thing to do. It is, honestly, and part of it's because of the culture of archaeology is people like what they like. People like what they're used to. So getting people to, it's hard enough just to make something that people can record within the field, but it's ultimately infinitely harder to get somebody to actually adopt that and use it in the field, because you'll have your people that just jump on it and they love it immediately, and that's great. But other people are gonna be like, well, I've been recording using these fields and in these ways for the last 30 years and I'm damned if I'm gonna change now. And those people, unfortunately, are running companies that are requiring their people to record in the same way. So you could have a bunch of people that really want to use something else, but they can't because the company has a certain standard and they don't really want to change that. And part of that, again, goes back to a paper legacy where, I mean, I know plenty of companies that have been using basically the same templates for reports and site records and everything for 20 or 30 years, and they've got the file cabinets to back that up. And they've got their own resources. They go in there and look. They like seeing. And I can, from an OCD standpoint, I can definitely see the desire to want this from a company owner standpoint. Like, I want to be able to look in any file cabinet and find something I find recognizable, and to start using a different format, even if it's the same information, is, you know, it's intimidating and it's scary. So, but we need to realize that that's the direction everything is going, is a more standardized recording process, I think is a really good thing for future viability of our data. You know, I'm not going to work in Nevada for the rest of my life. What if I'm in some other state and I'm working there and now I've got to learn their system? What do your site records look like? It's all the same information, but what does your stuff look like and how do I find things and blah, blah, blah. It just doesn't make any sense anymore. So
no. And, with CRM, you've got it often state by state, but in academic archaeology, it's often project by project. And when you talk about standardization, that's a huge problem, standardizing between one project and another. But I've worked on multi-year projects where even on paper, the forms change from 1 year to the next because they forgot to think of a particular artifact type that they want recorded, they want highlighted. And so the first few times that thing comes up, people scratch in, in the margins or in the notes on their page. And then after a bit, they realize that they want to be able to extract that as a particular data type. And so then it gets added to the new version of the form. And so, there's this flexibility that is great, mm-hmm. that people can be flexible, but it also makes for non-standard forms. And so the trick is really to make things that are going to be flexible in a way that can be standardized. If that makes any sense, it'd be interesting to see what WildNote has to do with this, because this ability to create and customize your own forms might just be the ticket, depending on how the data are managed.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right. Well, I think that's it for this week, Paul. Anything else?
Yeah. Covered plenty. No. Enjoy the winter weather in your place, and I'm watching everything melt out here.
Nice. I think by the time this releases and people hear it, everything will have melted here. So just a couple of days of cold. That's how life in the high desert is these days. So, all right. Well, we will be back again. If there's any topics you guys want us to cover, if you can recommend an article or something like that you want our take on, or maybe even you want us to find out if we can get a hold of the author of the article and get them on, or book or whatever, feel free to contact us. All the contact information is in the show notes at arcpodnet.com/archaeotech. And you can find us always there. So thanks a lot, Paul. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for listening to the ArchaeoTech Podcast. Links to items mentioned on the show are in the show notes at www.archpodnet.com/ArchaeoTech. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com and paul@lugal.com. Support the show by becoming a member at archpodnet.com/members. The music is a song called Off-Road and is license free from Apple. Thanks for listening.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.